All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I get to be your host today, and we're going to be talking about the Flying Tigers. Just before World War II, a number of pilots and aircraft and everything went over to China to see if they could prevent the Japanese from invading China. So you got to stay tuned for that story. The other thing, of course, we want to talk about a little bit today is it's Mother's Day, and we want to wish a happy Mother's Day out there, especially to the moms of the men and women who are deployed overseas. Our moms and dads and everyone that's out there, we want to make sure that they celebrate a happy Mother's Day. Don't forget, those of you that are listening that are in the service, you know where you are. Your mom doesn't know where you are. And in today's world, you don't have to do what my mom did when I was in Vietnam and actually sent me a stack of postcards that just said, I'm okay. And I was supposed to send one out every week just to make, you know, to relieve her concerns about what I was up to over there. So today, just send her an email, send her a text, whatever it is. If you haven't done it already, it's not too late. Make sure you get on the phone and call that woman. Without her, you would not be here. So wish her a happy, happy Mother's Day. We've got a couple of events coming up that I did want to mention that I think you'll find interesting. Number one is the wall is coming to Michigan, not once, but twice this summer. And it's going to start off with, let's see, where did that little note go? Here it is. The Michigan Vietnam Traveling Wall is going to be on display at up in Lapeer, Michigan. It's going to be at Racy's Harley-Davidson Friday and Saturday, May 25th and 26th. So the Michigan Traveling Wall will be on display, as I said, at Racy's Harley-Davidson in Lapeer. And that is at the intersection of M24 and I-69, exit 155. Starts at 9 o'clock on Friday and then starts again at noon on Saturday. For more information, it says to call Linda at 810-664-9261. Sounds like it might be a good time. Another event that's coming up on Thursday, May 24th, is a guest that we've had on our program, and it's Joanne Puffer-Kotcher, and she was a donut dolly in Vietnam. And for those of you that are not familiar with the term donut dolly, it means that it was a Red Cross volunteer. She spent a year in Vietnam, and she would go all over the country, and they got the name Donut Dolly because sometimes they would bring donuts with them. We didn't get a whole lot of donuts in Vietnam, and I know they didn't get a whole lot of them in World War II or Korea. So anyway, she's going to be talking about her story at the Royal Oak Public Library on 11 Mile in Royal Oak on Thursday, May 24th from 6:30 until 8 p.m. And she has a great book. It's really interesting. They'll be available for purchase, and she can she'll be autographing them as well. So that's Thursday night, May 24th, at the Royal Oak Public Library. Joanne's got a great story, and if you get to go, I think you'll really like it. Another thing coming up at the end of the month is you want to see a Tiger game? How about that? Come see the Detroit Tigers play the LA Angels. You can get two tickets, one for a veteran, one for their guest. All you've got to do is contact Operation Injured Soldiers. And Operation Injured Soldiers' number is 248-437-3130. That's 248-437-3130. And just give them a call, and they'll get the tickets to you. It says give them a call and let them know who you are and if you have any physical restrictions so that they can get some handicap seats, which are usually a lot better. At least they're not as crowded as some of the seats are there at Comerica Park. The last thing I wanted to bring up was that the FCA Foundation, and this is a Fiat Chrysler Foundation, is making possible for veterans to attend a special Veterans Military Afternoon at the DSO, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and their program that is going to be coming up there with it's the Doo-Wop Project, and it's going to be on Sunday, May 20th, at 3 p.m. at the DSO, and it says that for just $10, you can get to see the show. And for more information, you need to go to the DSO website, or you can go to the FCA Foundation and find out more information. It's only 10 bucks. You go to the website. It says for tickets, visit their website. Use promo code HEROESNIGHT, and It sounds like it's going to be fun. According to the their website, it says this: follow the evolution of doo-wop from tight harmonies sung in street corners to today's biggest hits. Stars of Broadway's Jersey Boys and Motown the Musical will harmonize classics from The Crest, The Flamingos, and The Temptations, all the way to Michael Jackson and Adele. Wow, that sounds like cool. Fortunately, I will be doing a radio show. Maybe I should do it from there. Sounds like a good idea to me. Anyway, those are some of the events that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. If you've got an event that you'd like us to promote here on Veterans Radio, please give us a call. We would love to promote it for you. This is what we're here for, to make sure that everybody finds out what is happening with you and what's going on around the world of veterans and veterans affairs. And that's all there is to that. We're going to be taking a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Sam Kleiner, and Sam is the author of the book, The Flying Tigers. And as I mentioned, The Flying Tigers is about this group of American airmen that were in China just prior to the beginning of World War II. They weren't really supposed to be there, but we're going to find out the whole story about them. So I want to make sure that you stay tuned. If you want to get in on this conversation, you can call us here at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after this quick message. We are going to be taking a little bit of a sentimental journey, and probably there are some people out there that don't remember that song, and then there are others of us that do, and probably some that are a little older than I am that remember it really well, because we're going to be talking about part of this greatest generation. We know that World War II veterans did more than anybody, in the history of the country to protect us, and we want to keep honoring them, and that's why we decided that we wanted to bring this this book to you. It's not even out. We're ahead of schedule, folks. I got to read this book online before anybody else did, so it's kind of cool. But joining me right now on Veterans Radio is Sam Kleiner. And Sam, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, and thank you for writing this book.
It's been a real journey to write this, and I'm so excited to bring this to you and your audience. As you mentioned, the book actually isn't even out yet. Until Tuesday, so your listeners are really going to get a sneak peek on what's in there, and I'm very excited to share this.
Well, it's a great story, Sam, and the title of the book is The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. How did you get involved with this?
So it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll the background is my grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific Theater during the war, and so I kind of grew up around his stories from the war, and you know that image of the greatest generation that you were talking about. I remember I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, so I'd go out with him to the Pima Air and Space Museum. He'd show me the different planes, and I kind of grew up with this interest. And I ended up going on and doing graduate work at the University of Oxford on a Marshall Scholarship and started really working on this period of history and really fell in love with it. You know, this is, as you talked about, this is right before World War II even started, before Pearl Harbor, but there was already stuff going on around the world. And in China, the war was going on since 1937 with a Japanese invasion. And I finally came across this topic and said, you know, I really want to write about this secret group of Americans that were already in China by the time Pearl Harbor happened. And they were the ones who fought the first battles after Pearl Harbor and scored these major victories that helped inspire American morale at a time when it seemed very dark. But the thing that really grabbed me when I started researching this was I came across a collection of love letters that were actually in an archive at Yale where I was doing my law degree. And they were love letters between a nurse and a pilot. The nurse was Emma Foster and this pilot, John Petak, who were part of the unit. And these letters, pages were pretty much falling apart, but you could still see the writing. And it was the two of them were in this unit together. And the letters going back and forth detailed not only their love story as they were going to Burma and then to China, but also, you know, the missions that John was flying and right after Pearl Harbor, and I knew that I had to write this. And so that's kind of what grabbed me to the topic. But I've spent the past couple of years getting together letters and diaries and combat reports that no one's ever seen before to really be able to tell the human side of the story.
Well, I think it's probably pretty difficult. I know that the Army Air Corps now the Air Force probably didn't make access to many of these records easy for you because this was, kind of a covert operation that was going on.
Right. So this is that's exactly right. This is a covert operation that's basically happening without any official authorization. So in the summer and fall of 1941, well before Pearl Harbor, America's still at peace. But if you were an Army pilot, you might get someone coming up to you at a bar or a pilot actually in any of the services, someone come up to you at a bar and say, how would you be interested in going on this secret mission to the Far East? And the mission was paying a lot more than these guys were making in the Army. And it was a chance for a lot of them to see the world. And so they signed up for it. But it was really a secret operation, and the full details of it wouldn't really be revealed for decades. So the actual combat reports that detail what these men did and allow the story to really be told for the first time weren't actually in the National Archives, where you would find, kind of Army Air Corps records.
Right.
Instead, the commander of the unit, this famous commander, Claire Chennault, ended up taking those records home with him after the war, and his family had them stored in a basement. And it wasn't until I went and found them in 2016, and they were completely out of order, just kind of sitting in a basement like a lot of families would have of kind of records from their family from the Greatest Generation, that you could start putting together what actually happened in this. So this is, this unit is fairly well known. Listeners might recognize the shark-faced P-40, that's kind of one of the definitive images of America at war, or have seen the John Wayne movie.
Right.
And those images were important for inspiring America in the early days of the war, but the full story of who the Tigers were and what happened to them hasn't been told until now.
Well, let's get into that story a little bit. Let's talk about Claire Chennault. Tell us about this guy. He was an amazing man in his own right. And didn't deal well with authority.
Yeah, Claire Chennault is definitely one of the most intriguing characters from World War II. So he's basically, he's from kind of the backwoods of Louisiana, and it takes him a long time to get into the Army and then to become a pilot. But ever since he first saw a plane at barnstorming right when planes were invented, pretty much, he decided he wanted to be a pilot. And he ends up becoming one of the first stunt pilots in the U.S. Army, but really has problems with the higher-ups in the Army who are saying, that bombers are really the future of the Army Air Corps. And he thinks that fighters, like the ones that he's flying, are. So these kind of doctrinal debates become very acrimonious. And in the late 1930s, he's pretty much pushed out of the Army. And at that point, at one of these air shows, he meets some representatives from the Chinese government, from Chiang Kai-shek's government, and they say, we'd love to hire you. We think your ideas are very interesting, and we want you to come do a survey of the Chinese Air Force. So in 1937, he goes over to China. He meets with Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who's the wife of Chiang Kai-shek, but is kind of in charge of running the Chinese Air Force, and they meet, and she sends him to go do a tour of the Chinese Air Force, and they kind of know there's going to be another war with Japan coming, but pretty much right after he gets there, the conflict breaks out again.
Mm-hmm.
And he's soon in charge of a group of Western pilots who are participating in active combat against the Japanese. So this is 4 years before Pearl Harbor, and most people don't know this, that there was this conflict that was already going on in China, and that there was a group of American pilots who were fighting there. So really, the story kind of takes off with these real mercenary pilots who are coming from, in some ways, from all over the world to help fight against the Japanese in China in that period. And it's just wonderful stories, that people haven't, that we don't tell as part of, our World War II stories about these Americans who are there trying to help the Chinese.
Well, I think it's a great story. Just the idea of reading about all these young men in this case that wanted to be pilots and how they fell in love with flying as you mentioned, you know, at very young ages because of all these barnstormers that they saw flying around, or the Wright brothers or whoever it might have been, and they decided that this is something that they wanted to do. And in the military in 1940, 41, they didn't get to actually be on any real missions.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you read, about some of these characters, like one of the main pilots in my book is Greg Pappy Boyington, who later becomes famous. There's a TV show about him in the 70s called Baba Black Sheep. Sheep Squadron.
He had some issues.
Yeah, he definitely had some issues, but he talks about, when he's growing up in Idaho, one of these barnstorming planes came through, and this is in the 1910s, barely after flight has been invented, and people got an entire town would kind of congregate to see a barnstorming plane come through and do tricks, and he got to actually for $5 go up on this plane and fly around, and so these guys were falling in love with flight. Just as it's being created. So mm-hmm. They kind of get to see the whole evolution of flight in their careers as pilots. And they're sitting around on these bases in 1940, 1941, and there's no action. But, they get these invitations to go to the Far East, and they want to take that up. So Boyington's sitting at a bar in Pensacola, Florida. He's a naval aviator. In 1941, and, he goes to the bar. He actually has a pretty troubled life, as you mentioned. His wife had recently left him. He has a lot of debt, and he goes up to the bar and he tries to buy a drink, though he knows the check he writes ultimately mm-hmm. isn't going to be able to be cashed. And someone next to him, he starts talking to him, and they said, how would you like to go go to the Far East, and you might have a chance to actually see some real action? He goes up to the hotel room where he's told to go, talks to this recruiter, and he thinks that the story is a little bit far-fetched, but he has nothing to lose, so he signs up for it. And so you have around 100 pilots, which was the size of this unit, who in the summer and fall of 1941, before Pearl Harbor, sign up and then are secretly, they're given passports with false identities, false professions, mm-hmm. and they head out to the West Coast and then get on these luxurious Dutch sea liners, and they head over to Burma and start training for this mission to help Chiang Kai-shek and help the Chinese. And this is all totally secret, but has been authorized by the Roosevelt administration that wants to help Chiang Kai-shek. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a complicated backstory in that sense, that it has a lot to do with the politics of the era. But the story is really told through the lens of these pilots who, are just on this great adventure. And for many of them, it's the first time they're getting to see the world kind of beyond the communities they grew up in.
Right, because many of them, it seemed like they were from all over the country. I mean, you had Ivy League graduates, you had people from the Midwest, you had guys from the California and so forth, who took on this adventure. Really, many of them not really knowing what they were getting into, and most of them had never seen combat.
Right. So most of them none of them had seen combat before. Very few of them had even left the country before. So right now there were about 100 pilots, another 200 ground crew. Now there's actually only one man left from the unit, one man still surviving. Mm-hmm. So I've been going to the reunions for the past couple of years to try and get documents, collect stories, talk to the families who still have these reunions every year. And the one man who's left, who I've become very close with, is a mechanic named Frank Lozanski. And Frank is originally from Detroit. He grew up in kind of really depression era Detroit. He talks about, his father was a barber, and, they would have this small barber shop. They barely were able to make ends meet. And then he joined the Army because he wanted to have a better life than, his family had been able to afford. And he failed, he couldn't pass his flight test, so he became a mechanic and was out at Selfridge Field working on P-40s, which were the planes. There were 100 P-40s that were sent as part of this unit. And a recruiter came by, and they really wanted mechanics who knew how to work with the P-40 to be part of the unit. And he had barely left Michigan before, and someone says, do you want to go to the Far East? And he said yes, but the only problem was he had to leave behind his girlfriend, Nancy. But they made an agreement that he was going to go do this. It was on a one-year contract, and then he'd come back and they'd get married, and they'd be able to, you know, the money that he was going to make doing this would kind of help them get started.
Right.
So he left and just had an incredible journey with the Flying Tigers, where he was, you know, even as a mechanic, the stories he had are just incredible. And it, you know, what really struck me is you were talking about the kind of greatest generation mentality. You know, they didn't have the tools they needed. They didn't have the supplies they needed to fix these planes, which was his job, just to keep everything flying. But his mentality was always kind of just, you know, just do what you need to do to get the plane in the air and make do with what you can. And he's become a very close friend in this writing process. He ended up moving back after the war, after the Flying Tigers period, which they ended in kind of July of 42, married Nancy, and they were married for over 70 years until she passed away in 2015. But Frank is still very proud of his service to the Flying Tigers, and one of the best parts of writing this book is getting to become friends with him.
Well, I would think so. I mean, the stories, folks, we're talking here with Sam Kleiner, who's the author of the book, The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan Prior to World War II actually beginning. And I strongly recommend this book. It was I got it and I was able to read it. I want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned, you know, how they got into China. They have a great website to tell our viewers to look at this, not in addition to reading a book. If you want to know more about the Flying Tigers and the, what do they call themselves, the American Volunteer Group.
So they're called the American Volunteer Group. And listeners can also check out the book website is flyingtigersbook.com. That has pictures that have never been published before of the group and all kinds of different information.
These are fascinating airplanes, folks. For any of you who like aviation at all, and I mean, I flew helicopters, so I didn't go quite as fast as these guys did, and I never got into a fight with another helicopter. but their stories are just amazing to me and such compelling stories that they have about, you know, fighting against these the Japanese pilots themselves and the Zero planes, and as you mentioned, trying to find parts and even trying to find planes. You talked briefly in the book about, you know, Claire Gannot trying to find these airplanes and trying to get them. Wasn't there a trade that they did with the English?
Yeah, well, they're basically, you know, so to kind of they get over there in the summer and fall of 1941. They set up shop in a remote air base in Burma, which at the time is a British colony called Tongo. And they're waiting there to get into action. And then Pearl Harbor happens on December 7, 1941, and then they snap into action. And they need to go to China to help get in the fight. So they show up there in early December 1941, and their first battle is on December 20th, 1941. And they're flying these T-40 fighter planes, which are a good plane, but not really top of the line. They're made by Curtiss up in Buffalo, New York. And so at this point, the Chinese in cities like Kunming and Chongqing have been bombed by the Japanese for 4 years, four very long years of kind of continual bombardment and aggressive war by the Japanese. And the Japanese are used to being able to just fly their bombers in and drop their payload and not really have any opposition at this point. And so on December 20th, the Flying Tigers launch into battle over Kunming and are able to shoot down a number of the Japanese bombers. And so we're talking, you know, just less than 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And this becomes, you know, so the stories from these pilots about going and taking on the Japanese planes are incredible. Because they're, you know, they have to kind of fly in and dive down and attack from the top, which is the tactic that Chenault wanted them to use. They all survive that first, all of the Americans survive that first battle. One guy ends up crashing because he basically runs out of gas and has to stay overnight with a group of Chinese that kind of welcome him in, and then he comes back the next day. And so there's really a celebratory feel to this first victory. And what's amazing to me is that this is at a time when, you know, Americans and our allies are losing battles all over the world. So it's not only the attack on Pearl Harbor, but throughout the month of December 1941, Singapore, Wake Island, a series of different battles mm-hmm. in the Pacific are lost, and Americans are gravely concerned about invasion of the West Coast. There's blackouts along the West Coast, a sense that, you know, we're going to be overrun by the Japanese, and there was a desperate need for a feeling of victory. You know, America at the time had the 18th largest military in the world. This was not a war that we felt like we were going to win. And so all of a sudden you get this incredible story of these American pilots in China who are fighting and beating the Japanese. So Time magazine in December 29th runs an article about these pilots and comes up with the name the Flying Tigers. And that's how the American Volunteer Group becomes the Flying Tigers. And this mythology starts around them, that they're the most heroic pilots of the war.
It's,
John Wayne. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, it certainly sounds like we got less than a minute. We have to take a break. But again, reminding our audience, we're talking with Sam Kleiner. He's the author of The Flying Tigers. And I'd strongly encourage people to read this because there's a fascinating story. Not only you kind of feel like you're in the cockpit in these dogfights that they are having with the Japanese Zero planes, but it's hair-raising. I mean, it's frightening. I can't imagine going after another airplane at 200 or 300 miles an hour and everybody shooting at each other. But we can hear that. We're coming up on a break, as I said, and we've got, I got 10 seconds. So hold on, Sam. We'll be right back with you. You're
great.
Listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after the news. And we're back on Veterans Radio, listening to a little World War II music by the Andrews Sisters there. We're talking with Sam Kleiner. He's the author of the book, The Flying Tigers, and the Untold Story of American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan prior to, you know, getting totally involved after Pearl Harbor. I think what's interesting, Sam, is that if we look at, as you mentioned, them going out and taking care of some Japanese bombers there on the 20th, that the first couple of weeks, as you mentioned, after Pearl Harbor, the Americans kept losing island after island and the Philippines, you know, everything in the Western Pacific, you know, eventually fell under the control of the Japanese. And these Flying Tigers were able to go out and actually get a victory. And can you kind of explain maybe a little bit to our audience, you did briefly earlier, about how important this was to the morale of America?
Absolutely. So when President Roosevelt goes to Congress after the attack on Pearl Harbor, he lists off a long series of attacks that have happened. So it's not just Pearl Harbor,
right,
but as you mentioned, it's the loss of the Philippines, Wake Island, the British colonies, Singapore, and so on. And there's this growing sense of fear on the West Coast with these blackouts and a sense of an impending attack. And so there was really a need for a sense that, you know, we could win this war. And so the Flying Tigers, by virtue of the fact that there was this secret mission to send them over before Pearl Harbor, are really the first Americans in a position to get in the battle. And this becomes the major story for the early period of the war, the exploits of the Flying Tigers. Hollywood obviously recognizes a good story when they see one, and they rush out this production of The Flying Tigers starring John Wayne, kind of loosely based on Claire Chennault. That movie comes out in 1942, the war is still ongoing, and it kind of portrays the Flying Tigers as these American heroes. So even before the Doolittle raid that happens in April 1942, it's really the Flying Tigers that start to inspire Americans, become front page news about how the war could actually be won.
You mentioned the Doolittle raid, and that's to remind our audience, that was done off of an aircraft carrier, and it was a revenge bombing where they, you know, American aircraft were able to bomb Tokyo, but they didn't have any place to go, and they didn't have enough fuel to get back to safety in many cases. And Claire Chennault, who is a the head of our Flying Tigers here, he was a little upset by that because he thought that he could have helped him out.
Right. It's, you know, kind of, it's one of those things, you know, in war, there's always two sides to these stories. And so Chenault and this unit was technically part of the Chinese Air Force while it was going mm-hmm. on up until July of 1942 when they were merged back into the U.S. Army. And so Chenault wasn't kind of given the advance warning about the Doolittle raid where they were going to bomb Tokyo and then crash land these B-25s in China. And he always said in his memoir, he said, you know, decades later, I'm still angry about this because he thought that not only could he have helped the pilots who went down, some of whom were taken prisoner by the Japanese and killed, but that he also could have then used those B-25 bombers
right.
and started to really take the fight against the Japanese. And that was always Chenault's main complaint throughout his time with the Flying Tigers. And as a commander with the 14th Air Force, which succeeded them, was that he felt like he never was getting the supplies and the planes that he needed if he was going to win the war. And so he always had this sense, even though he became a public hero, that he was not being taken seriously in Washington, and that people were kind of disrespecting him, and that really lingered with him throughout the war.
Well, you know, he certainly did a lot with what he had. Can you kind of describe? I let you do this. I mean, I was fascinated by this story. Can you tell the conditions that these men lived under, and then not the really great conditions, but when I mean they're out in the middle of jungles. For months at a time, trying to keep these, you know, these P-40s in the air.
Yeah, it's interesting when people hear the Flying Tigers, we tend to associate them with China, but actually a lot of their fighting ended up happening in Burma, which is the British next to China during the war, and in that period they really had really rough conditions. So at a certain point they're kind of out in this field, basically in the middle of nowhere, called Mogwe, and they are kind of outgunned by the Japanese, and they're kind of living off the land. And the Japanese kind of at this point are pushing into Burma and keep pushing them back. So the British lose Rangoon, which is the capital, and then the Flying Tigers are really fighting this kind of what they call aerial guerrilla warfare, you know, just kind of going from spot to spot and trying to stay alive. But yeah, this jungle stuff you talk about is definitely some of the most memorable part of it from the experience of the veterans. When I talked to Frank Lozanski, who's the individual I mentioned earlier, who's this mechanic from Detroit, when they first showed up in Burma for their training, they were kind of let loose. They were allowed to do whatever they wanted as long as, you know, it didn't interfere with their ability to fly. So Frank, you know, kind of goes hunting in the jungle, and they were told, you know, you might find a tiger or something. They never found a tiger, but they definitely were living in these very exotic conditions. They would have monkeys living with them in their barracks. And the food obviously was very different than what they were used to back home. So for a lot of these guys, you know, someone like Frank, who's, you know, kind of just from Detroit and hasn't really seen much of the world beyond Michigan, he signs up for this mission, and a month later, he's living in the jungle in Burma. So for all these guys, it was really, you know, just a totally new experience.
But they did have some good places where they lived. Where was Chenault? I can't recall the name of the town right now where they lived in an old resort.
Yeah, so they're in Kunming in China for a while, and then they're affiliated kind of throughout this process with a company called Camco, CAMCO, which is kind of a private company that sells planes in China. And that company is run by an individual named William Polly, who someone described as a mix of Indiana Jones with Donald Trump, just kind of a guy who's gone all over the world to make deals selling planes. And he had built kind of this resort town on the border between China and Burma that was nicknamed Polyville, named after him. And at one point, the Flying Tigers kind of get stationed there. And so they're going out and fighting these missions, but they come back and they have someone who's cooking these elaborate meals for them, staying in these very nice almost like resort-style rooms. And so it's this kind of incredible contrast when you're reading their diaries and looking at their letters. You know, they talk about how nice of an upgrade this was. So it's just one of these stories that's kind of larger than life. You know, there's so much packed into it where they, you know, they're going back and forth kind of between being on the front lines and this, you know, sense of almost incredible luxury. And so for a lot of these guys, you know, your day to day, your life is just changing so much. Mm-hmm. And so I was lucky that so many of these guys were incredible diarists and incredible letter writers, that a lot of that information kind of allows me and allows the reader to kind of be there with them. And I think the book carries with it a lot of that sense of what it was like to actually be there with them.
I would agree with that. And I don't think many of our listeners, I know I wasn't as aware from my, you know, history classes of what was really going on around China at the time, that, you know, that Japan was not only attacking from the east, but they've gone around and now they're attacking from the west and from the south. And their type of bombing was that they bombed civilians, which is
absolutely.
Which is one of the things.
So it's, you know, I think when, you know, like when most Americans think about World War II, kind of, I think our defining images are D-Day and kind of the war in Europe, and the Pacific always gets overlooked to a certain degree. You know, we might think about Iwo Jima and some of the island campaigns, but China is really, you know, the forgotten ally in the war, as one historian has put it. And their war really stretches from 1937 when the Japanese attack up through 1945. And so it's, you know, horrific massacres like the Rape of Nanking. And then you also get just massive aerial bombardment. So even before we saw that later in the war happening in Europe, you see, you know, the destruction of cities like Chongqing, which was the Chinese capital, by Japanese bombers. And so it's almost kind of a preview of what you see later in the war. And there was a real need for pilots and planes to help defend China against the Japanese bombers. And that's why Chiang Kai-shek was so interested in ensuring that he could get American planes and pilots to come over. Mm-hmm. So the Flying Tigers are really the product of this intensive lobbying by the Chinese in Washington to get planes and pilots to come over. And so a lot of what the book tries to also detail is how there were American policymakers. It was actually Secretary Morgenthau, who was the Treasury Secretary of all things, who was really the brains behind getting this all to happen. And you see people, you know, kind of some of the first lobbyists in Washington, this guy, Tommy the Cork Corcoran, who were really involved in pushing this. So there's this whole layer of foreign intrigue and kind of backroom deals that's also happening. And I wanted to make sure to kind of convey that, and I think that that's an important part of the story that you know, we don't always think about when we think about World War II. You know, the war started for America on December 7th, 1941, but a lot of the action that's in the book is going back for quite a ways before that.
Right, and there's a lot of intrigue, and as you mentioned in there, and you're talking about the Japanese continually kept pushing through Burma, eventually forcing the Flying Tigers to move into China, and there was one interesting story where it talks about the English aristocrats that were living, and I forget the name of the city, but they didn't really get the word about, you know, that they needed to leave. They needed to evacuate, and they were all dressed in their formal clothing to evacuate.
Yeah, so the loss of Burma, which was a kind of a major British colony, was pretty unexpected for the British, and so Rangoon, which was the capital, was a very important lifeline for China, because that was through the Burma Road, the last port access that the Chinese had to the outside world. So part of the mission of the Flying Tigers was to defend Rangoon. But that really became impossible after the Japanese started to have a real land assault on Rangoon. And the work that the Flying Tigers were doing in the air just wasn't going to save the city. So the Flying Tigers actually, you know, in this period when Rangoon is really starting to fall apart, were housed with some of these British aristocrats, you know, from oil companies and so on. So they would go out and fight by day, and then they would come back to these elaborate estates You know, they'd have servants who would cook them dinner, and they would, you know, drink cognac, and they would, you know, enjoy kind of sitting at the piano. But on the radio, you know, you could hear the reports of how the war was just getting worse, and they saw it. And so, you know, a lot of the story of the Flying Tigers is, you know, they're depicted, you know, in the John Wayne movies and in the newspapers as kind of these major heroes. But a lot of it was, you know, just fighting from loss to loss. And one of the inspiring things for me about the story was seeing that perseverance. There was one moment where they almost, you know, there was a kind of a mass resignation, but Chenault really rallied them and said, you know, they wanted to see this through. And so, you know, a lot of the story that's touching to me is not about, you know, just the depiction of these guys as heroes, but really trying to understand how, you know, they were committed to the mission, they were committed to Chenault, and they wanted to keep persevering, even after, you know, some of their you know, the best pilots in the unit were killed. They were really committed to this mission.
I wanted to, you know, we've kind of depicted that sometimes these guys lived in the lap of luxury, but a lot of them, unfortunately, were killed.
Absolutely. And, you know, with Memorial Day coming up, it's something we, you know, we obviously want to acknowledge that, you know, these, a number of these pilots were killed. One of the stories that I found most touching when I was doing this research was the story of this guy, Jack Newkirk, who they called Scarsdale because he was from Scarsdale, New York. Mm-hmm. And he had kind of a, you know, a well-off background, and, he'd been an aviator before joining up with the Flying Tigers, but he kind of came for a sense of adventure, and he got married to his girlfriend right before he left, and their honeymoon was basically going to San Francisco to watch him get on the boat to go over to China.
Yes.
And there's a picture in the book of him with his wife, Jane, right as they're on the docks before he's about to leave. And that picture was discovered in someone's attic, you know, decades later. And so he goes over, and Jack Newkirk scores some of the first victories for the Flying Tigers, and he basically becomes a household name. The exploits of Scarsdale Newkirk are written up in the papers. But in March of 1942, Chenault ordered a major raid against a Japanese position deep in Thailand. And the raid was incredibly successful. They took out a huge amount of Japanese planes on the ground, but they lost Scarsdale Newkirk. And they don't know exactly what happened, why his plane went down, but it kind of crashed along a road, and he was killed. And the other pilots in their diaries talk about, you know, how they went back afterwards, and they're, you know, they're at their bar, they're kind of drinking and celebrating the raid, and this other pilot, Charlie Bond, writes in his diary, you know, was it right for us to be drinking and celebrating when we had just lost one of our best pilots? And I don't know the answer to that. And that just really stuck with me as something that's, you know, very hard for these guys as they have to, you know, the next day pick up and keep fighting. And even though they're losing some of their, you know, their people they'd become good friends with and their squadron mates.
I think that's always difficult to do that. It's, you know, to keep on keeping on, sort of. We're talking with Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. One of the most emotional stories for me was the story of Bill Reed, the one from Iowa.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to give away all your stuff. I want people to go out and buy this book. I think it's really important. But if you could just kind of explain that story.
Absolutely. I think there's enough stories in there that people will, go out and buy the book, they'll find plenty more there. But yeah, so I can talk a bit about Bill Reed, and I've become very close with his family. So Bill was a young man from Marion, Iowa, and he joins up with the unit with the Flying Tigers, kind of just out of a sense of adventure. He's barely left the state of Iowa, went to school there, and just saw this as an opportunity to have a great adventure. And he kept a remarkable diary that the family had years later. And he has a number of great exploits at the Flying Tigers, but in his diary, he's constantly talking about how much he misses his mother, and the sense that he wants to go home. And he gets that chance ultimately in July of 1942. The Flying Tigers basically are merged into the Army Air Force. And he, and the pilots are given a decision. Do you want to go home and then you can kind of rejoin your unit and re-enter the war? Or do you want to stay? And most of them decide they want to go home, see their families, and then re-sign up for the remainder of the war. And so they, basically, their problem is they have to find a way to get home. The Army isn't going to help them really do that. And so Bill and his buddy R.T. Smith, who's from Nebraska, they kind of are the leaders in finding a way home. So they go to India, and they find a ship that's going to New York. And so they figured that's a pretty good idea, that a big group of them get on this ship. They're having a great time, and they land in New York City. And Bill Reed and R.T. Smith are these small-town guys who've never seen the Big Apple, and they have a pretty wild week on the town. They talk about going out to these fancy clubs and going out to late hours of the night. But the problem is that Bill Reed has to get home to Marion, Iowa for Bill Reed Day that's being held in his honor. And so he misses his train because he claims he can't find his way there in Grand Central. Finally gets there, basically missing the first half of the parade, and there's this huge festival held in his honor. Because for these small towns, they needed a hero. They needed someone they could look to kind of to show that the war was going to be okay. And so he had become this kind of massive hero back in Iowa. And then eventually he does sign up to go back to China because Chenault wanted his best pilots to come back. And then in later in the war, he's ultimately killed on another mission when his base was under attack and his plane couldn't land, and a bunch of guys had to bail out of their planes. And the other one survived, but it seems like he hit him against his plane as he was trying to bail out. And that became a real source of mourning for the community in Marion, that they had lost kind of their beloved son during the war. And so the book is just full of, you know, I could talk about it, any number of these individual pilots whose stories really touch you. And Chenault, you know, was deeply attached to them. You know, the loss, he really felt the loss of Reed like he felt the loss of a son, he said. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the book was kind of emotionally exhausting at a certain level to write, because you become so invested in, you know, understanding these young men and then realizing that, you know, so many of them don't come back.
I think that's the real crux of the emotional issue that many people have in reading this, is that you get attached to these characters and then, you know, they're gone for some reason or another. Some of them, though, you had a couple of them that were captured and, or, you know, people thought were dead, but they weren't. Could you touch on Boynton was one of them. If you could touch on that just real quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So Boynton, you know, has a kind of a troubled tenure with the Flying Tigers. He ends up getting to command a unit called the Black Sheep Squadron. And he races to set the record for the most number of planes shot down. And he ties it on the same day in early 1944 that he's shot down and presumed dead. There's no record of anyone recovering him. And so he's officially listed as dead. Though his mother maintained that, you know, she believed he was still alive. After the war, they're flying around to kind of liberate the Japanese POW camp, and they're taking a picture of one of the camps, and they see on the roof of the barracks, it says Boynton alive. And they go to liberate the camp, and sure enough, they find that he's pretty much back from the dead, that he'd been captured and still was alive. And so he gets to go to the White House, and Harry Truman pins the Medal of Honor on him. But that didn't really cure, you know, he had a very troubled life, and he would spend the rest of it, you know, kind of with a very troubled relationship with the fame that came with that, and with a serious problem with alcoholism.
Well, there are a lot of, I mean, you can understand some, you know, a lot of that with what they did during the war. We've only got about 2.5 minutes to go. So I'm going to give you a chance to tell what happened at the end of the war. What happened to Chenault? What happened to the Flying Tigers?
Absolutely. And listeners can also go online to flyingtigersbook.com and check out, you know, any number of pictures and stories. And I'd encourage them to get the book. It's available on Amazon and will be out in bookstores on Tuesday. So I think there's a lot more in there. And Chenault's interesting because he's, you know, he's pretty much gone from the U.S. from 37 to 45. So he comes home in 1945. He kind of gets kicked out of the army a little bit again because he has problems listening, you know, to authority, which is just kind of his demeanor. And he's welcomed back to Louisiana as kind of a homecoming hero. But that's not what he wants. You know, he feels more at home in China than he does in Louisiana. So he moves back to China, marries a young woman who became Anna Chenault, his second wife. And he starts up an airline that becomes known as CAT that ultimately becomes the CIA's private airline. And so he kind of has this second career kind of in these shadow wars in East Asia. And so I touch on that in the book towards the end as well, and ultimately kind of show how some of these flying tigers, you know, end up flying supplies into Dien Bien Phu in 1954, becoming, you know, kind of part of the first bit of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. And so there's kind of a story of, you know, these covert operations in East Asia that gets told through the flying tigers as well. And I think, you know, it has resonance for a lot of how we see modern warfare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I totally agree, and I strongly encourage people to read this book. There's a lot of characters that come in and out of it, names that especially military historians will recognize, or people that are, you know, interested in that type of thing. I think they'll find it very interesting. I want to thank you very much, Sam, for being on Veterans Radio today. And I encourage everybody to go to our website or go to Amazon. You just click on the cover and get a hold of this book. I think you'll find it fascinating and really an important look back at history.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again. Thank you. All right. That's it for another Veterans Radio. Next week we will be back. And how much time have I got? About 10 seconds or less. All right. Anyway, we'll be back next week with another live story for you. You've been listening to Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.